You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although the Mongols were a small tribe in the 13th century, under the leadership of Genghis Khan, they created the largest contiguous empire in history. It stretched across Eurasia from Karakorum, the ancient capital of Mongolia, through Kazakhstan, Russia, the Crimea, and Ukraine, to the Danube River in Hungary. 8 centuries later, author and filmmaker Tim Cope traveled the emperor's route on horseback, and he writes about it in his new book, On the Trail of Genghis Khan, An Epic Journey Through the Land of Nomads. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased that it's brought Tim Cope to our show today. Hello.
Good afternoon.
How great a distance did that require you to travel?
Something around about 6,000 miles, but of course, by horse, I'll never know exactly how far it was.
And
it was
then again, you had a couple of digressions.
Yeah, I think I set off quite naively. In fact, I set off with an Excel spreadsheet. I'd worked out that if I did 20 kilometres a day for 5 days a week and had the weekends off, I'd make it to Hungary in 16 months, add on a couple of months for holiday, and there I had my 18-month journey. But of course, 3.5 years later, I made it to the Danube River in Hungary, and it had kind of encompassed everything in my life. It wasn't just a journey.
Well, can you describe the range of climate and terrain over that area that you covered?
The steppe is it's a prairie-like environment that stretches from Mongolia as far as the Danube River, kind of taking up the inner core of the Eurasian continent. It's far away from any ocean, so you've got that heavily continental climate. It's minus 50 degrees Celsius. I guess that's about minus 55 in Fahrenheit. It's 120 degrees Fahrenheit in the summer. It's a place that ranges from glaciated mountains to arid grasslands, deserts. There's not much water, and for me, that really laid down the main challenge, the everyday challenge, that was finding grass and water for my animals.
So it was always a bit cold?
No, the summers were extremely hot. They have what they call, in the middle of Kazakhstan in the summer, the 40 days in a row of above 40 degrees, or that's above 110 degrees Fahrenheit. And that involved actually saddling up after dark, riding through till dawn, and finding shelter with the people before it got too hot.
Did you pass through towns and cities as you were doing this journey?
At times, but the concept of the journey was to really break away and transcend the modern era, get away from roads, because, of course, nomads have been riding horses since they were domesticated about 5,500 years ago on the centre of the Eurasian steppe. So getting on a horse enabled me to participate in their culture, in their lives, and to kind of fulfil that boyhood dream of travelling through a land where there's thousands of miles, there's no fences, and the people, of course, live in this environment in symbiosis with it, with their animals, moving with the seasons, with little more usually than a couple of inches of tent felt, insulating them from the extremes.
Well, nomads are moving around, as you say, with their animals. Mm-hmm. That's quite different than trying to conquer half the world.
Absolutely.
So what happened? Did the nomadic thing, was it distorted when Genghis Khan took over? Was he the first to lead an army to conquer parts of the world, or was
Absolutely
he part
not,
of a Mongolian tradition?
If you go back to the domestication of the horse 5,500 years ago, it was a point in history when suddenly tomorrow could become today, essentially. Suddenly you could travel up to 100 miles if you had to, whilst until that point in history, humans were kind of limited to how far they could walk in a day. And from that moment, nomads had been stretching out right across the steppe from Asia to Europe. And then Mongols are just one in a very long line of nomad empires. We've all probably heard of Attila the Hun, but there are many other groups. The Kazakhs have their own unique history as nomads. There are the Tatars of Crimea. There are more modern nomadic nations such as Kalmykia, the only Buddhist republic these days in geographical Europe. So they've all got this heritage of being nomads, but also of being conquerors, because being on a horse gave them incredible advantage over sedentary societies.
But they were also in the lands that Genghis Khan conquered. So you could have an empire and then later be conquered by the next big leader?
Essentially, I mean, Hungary, I think, is a really interesting example of steppe history. It's the western fringe of the steppe, so essentially the driving force of nomadic migrations is to essentially seek better lands, better pastures for the animals, water and so forth. And Hungary is the edge of it, and so it's a very rich land, and you'd have these nomadic groups who'd arrived there. But the problem is that it was almost too good to be nomadic. If the grass, if there's plenty of grass, there's no reason to be migrating hundreds of miles. So they'd become settled, they'd begin to adopt sedentary practices like cultivating the land, and they'd soften. And then, of course, the next wave of nomadic groups would come in, they'd take over, they'd wipe them out and settle the nation. And the Hungarians' ancestors, the Magyars, did just that in the 9th century.
Isn't the Hungarian language unique in Europe?
It is unique in Europe. It's not that unique in the scheme of the steppe. It's loosely related to many of the Turkic languages. In fact, the Magyars themselves came from a place in northern Kazakhstan, southern Siberia, in the 9th century. And there's a group of nomads called the Kipchaks who still exist today in Kazakhstan and southern Russia.
So they don't speak a Slavic language?
No, not at all. It's totally unrelated. It's the bulwark, if you like, of the steppe as it reaches Europe.
Now, you speak Mongolian? You speak Russian?
I speak Russian. I've been speaking Russian since I was about 21.
That got you through a large part of this area, didn't it?
It definitely did. Without Russian, I wouldn't have been able to communicate with the people and understand the issues that they were facing. I mean, when I arrived in Kazakhstan, that's where the guts of the journey was for me, and I started to grapple with a lot of the issues that the people are facing. Kazakhstan used to resemble Mongolia as a nomad nation. In fact, it was the most populous nomad nation of all in the Eurasian steppe. However, in the early 30s, Stalin came in with industrialization, dispossessed the nomads, and within a couple of winters, the animal numbers had dropped by 80 or 90%, and the people began to starve. In fact, one-third of the population perished in a famine that some would argue was a genocide, and those people who remained alive were forced to integrate into Soviet society.
So that's because of collectivization?
Collectivization. Essentially, their animals were taken away. A lot of them were shipped off to Russia to meet unrealistic quotas for wool and meat, and without animals on the steppe, there is no life.
Well, the collectivization required taking over people's property, but in the case of nomads, they didn't have property, so their animals were considered their property?
Exactly, yeah. And because they didn't own land, they couldn't take their land, so they took their animals. And through a process of mismanagement, and some would argue intentionally, it led to the deaths of as many as 2.2 million nomads.
Now, Kazakhstan is still a troubled country. It's been in the news again recently because of a power struggle, the daughters of the dictator. Is it still the legacy of the Soviet Union or the legacy of all of this stuff, Genghis Khan and everything that followed?
Well, Kazakhs as a nomadic people were brothers in arms with the Mongols, with Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan used that vast Eurasian steppe as his freeway, as his board for mounting campaigns. So the Kazakhs have a close relationship, like it or not, with the Mongols and Genghis Khan.
Do they look Asian?
Oh, very much so, yeah. And you could argue that Russians look very Kazakh because they say that if you scratch a Russian, you'll find a Tatar, which is very true. But now Kazakhstan is emerging not only from the Soviet era, but from the Russian Empire that preceded it. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, it was essentially the Russian Empire collapsing as well. And in 1990, it was very difficult for these people who had lived through the famine. They'd seen all of the destruction. They had then adapted their lives to this system only for it to disintegrate. So I was entering a country that they didn't have the traditional nomad knowledge to fall back on. Neither did they have this Soviet system that they'd become so dependent on. And in that vacuum, of course, it had been filled with corruption, a lot of lawlessness, and a sense of identity crisis, really. And in that kind of moment of turmoil, there is this driving forces of the market economy, and Kazakhstan has huge oil resources, so companies like Chevron were already trying to negotiate with the government in the early 1990s to develop the oil fields of the Caspian Sea. And some people suggest that Kazakhstan could be producing as much oil as Saudi Arabia within a decade. So there's that going on. And then there's this opportunity to revive their culture and celebrate it, which is something they couldn't do in Soviet times.
My guest is Tim Cope. His book On the Trail of Genghis Khan, An Epic Journey, The Land of the Nomads, taken on horseback largely. You'd earlier done other treks on bicycle now and other parts of Asia, partly because you're an Australian and that seemed to be the best place to go.
I think I've always been fascinated about these places I know nothing about. But when I was 20, I studied in Finland, and I learned about Russia. Back in 1998, it was a place where the economy had just collapsed. I went there, the sense of spontaneity, the chaos that was going on, the humanity really attracted me, and I loved getting in these old Russian larders that would bump along these terrible roads, feeling the gravel hitting up from the inside of the car. I loved that. I hated the sterility of life in Finland where I was studying, where everything was so calm and so precise. And that journey by bicycle led me, after 14 months, to Mongolia.
Now, because of politics, it's impossible to do the whole trip on horseback. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, you talk about your horse being stolen, your horses being stolen early in the trip. So not everybody was welcoming as you started taking this journey?
No, on the fifth day of my journey, I woke up in the middle of the night and there was this... At first I could hear silence, which was a worry given that I'd tied the animals up a few hours earlier near the tent. And I listened more carefully. There came this sniggering and then horses galloping into the night. And I leapt out and the only thing I could find was, in fact, the bell that the equine vet in Australia had suggested that I put on the horse at night so that when the horses got nervous and the thieves approached, the bell would ring and then I would have my opportunity to leap out and rescue them in time. In reality...
Did you have a weapon?
No, I didn't have any weapon. I mean, quite simply, I'd imagined this beautiful green grasslands unrolling unendingly into the horizon. I'd have a compass in one hand. I'd slap my gear on the back of a horse and off I'd go. One friend had even said to me, just keep riding to the west following the setting sun, and when the people start speaking French, you know that you've gone too far. Mm-hmm. And there was a wonderful simplicity to it, but I was also naive, and I leapt out of the tent, and the horses were gone. Fortunately, a friend had said that if you don't solve your problems in Mongolia before dawn, then you probably never will. I headed off, and I found this herd of horses, and my horses were among them, and this man came up and intimated, well, you must have tied your horses really badly. They came to me themselves, and it didn't really matter who'd stolen them at that point. He took me back to his home. We feasted on some fermented mare's milk called arak and ate some goat, and he taught me this wonderful step proverb, which is that a man on the step without friends is as narrow as a finger, and a man on the step with friends is as wide as the step.
Well, you couldn't have many friends. Genghis Khan traveled with 100,000 soldiers. You sometimes had your girlfriend who came over from Australia. Other than that, just people you met along the way?
Yeah, my girlfriend Catherine was with me for the first 6 weeks, and the idea was that she would join me during her work holidays. However, she developed Cushing syndrome, had brain surgery. We broke up, and she was married by the time I reached Hungary. But that's another story into itself. What I learned from that first experience was all about reaching out to people, learning about them, making friends, even with people who I didn't necessarily feel like I wanted to associate with. And I wasn't entirely alone because I was also offered a dog called Tigan as I headed into my first blizzards in Kazakhstan, and this herder said to me, Tim, you definitely need someone on this long journey to keep you company, to keep you warm at night in the tent and protect you from the wolves. And he gave me this scrawny little runt that was so skinny, if he turned side on in the grass, he was almost invisible. But within a day of leaving Asset, he'd already become my best friend, and I couldn't have done the journey without Tigan.
You say one of the main challenges of this journey would be treading the fine line between the dangers of the wilds and those of the human sort. Which one turned out to be scarier, the animals or the people?
They say that the most dangerous wolf is the one that walks on two legs. And there is an element of truth in that. When I travelled through Kazakhstan, I always made sure that wherever I stopped, no one could see where I'd been or where I was camping, because the threat of people coming the night was always there. However, there's a few, quite many occasions that made me reflect on the duality of life on the steppe, this simultaneous existence of cruelty, kindness, this wilderness that can kill you is also the wilderness that nurtures you. And there was one occasion when a guy came up to me in the night in Kazakhstan and said, I've heard from the village that someone's going to come to steal your horses tonight. I brushed it off. I'd been in the wilderness. No one knew I was there. But sure enough, middle of the night, there's this crashing and banging. I leapt out, and I could just see this silhouette of a guy stumbling into the distance. He'd leapt on my horse bareback and tried to gallop off without realising that it was still tied by the lower left leg. And the horse had somersaulted and thrown this guy off. And I got some other guys from this remote railway siding. We caught him, brought him back. And, of course, it was the same man who'd warned me about horse stealing earlier on. And they all said, well, the only thing to do in this situation is to drink vodka. We did that, and he stole the horses again. We caught them back, and I left in the morning. He said something to me like, according to Barimta, which is this tradition, if you've had something stolen from you, you can steal something back. And he said, well, according to the tradition, you can steal my wife, but if you do, take her all the way to Hungary. And I kind of rode off in two minds. On one hand, feeling very much under threat. How could these people threaten my existence? Because without a horse out there, you're nothing. On the other hand, there was no malice. There was a sense of friendship. And that says a lot about that fine line between friend and enemy.
You have a photograph of the wife? Well, just one more thing. Some of the politics of the area made it impossible for you to just keep on riding on horseback. Didn't you have to actually fly over one border?
Yeah, there was one border.
Take a train at one point?
There was one border when I, about probably 150 miles when I couldn't ride, but that was it. The rest of it was a... And that's a border that runs between Russia, Kazakhstan, and Mongolia, artificially kind of dividing these people that are from the same background, the same heritage.
How many of them remain nomads today?
Well, the steppe's at a real juncture at this point. Mongolia in the 20th century has been reasonably inaccessible. And until recently, there was probably about 50% of the population were still nomadic. However,
when I collected stamps, there was Inner Mongolia and Outer Mongolia. One went with the Soviet Union and one went with China.
Yeah, not entirely true. Inner Mongolia went with China, but Mongolia remained separate from the Soviet Union. It was a satellite state, but it was never part of the Soviet Union. It never suffered collectivization of the 30s under Stalin. It suffered somewhat, but the nomadic way of life remained intact. And ironically, in a way, it's since the fall of the Soviet era that the real threat has emerged, and that really is big mining. This year, one of the largest copper mines in the world opened. It's sitting on about $350 billion of copper and gold reserves. And that kind of economy very quickly begins to marginalise nomadic herding economy. And so it begins to change the aspirations, the traditional values. And so there's a slow erosion. It's actually not that slow, but it's happening at the moment in Mongolia. In fact, Mongolia of today is not the same Mongolia that I left in 2004. And I've been returning to Mongolia every year since.
Tim Cope's book On the Trail of Genghis Khan, An Epic Journey Through the Land of the Nomads, with lots of wonderful pictures as well, published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.